here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Hello, and welcome to Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. A little confession to make. Valentine's is probably my least favorite holiday. When I was a kid, I didn't like it because there were always a lot of kids at school that got lots of Valentines, and then there were kids that didn't get any Valentines, and I didn't like that. When I got older, I very quickly realized that all the Valentine's Day movies and fantasies you see on TV and in magazines are just that, fantasies. Most men might send a few flowers, or in my case, would often forget altogether, and so I learned to dislike Valentine's Day even more. For a few years, I really enjoyed helping my kids make their little Valentine's Day boxes to take to school, and I liked preparing their cards for them to give to their friends. But then when my youngest finished the sixth grade, which is the last year that kids exchange Valentines here in the States, I realized my kids were growing up, and that made me very, very sad. Plus, there's just something that feels a bit phony about having to perform an act of love on a certain day of the year. Shouldn't we just always perform acts of love for those we care about? So no, I haven't loved Valentine's Day for a long time. This year, because of my granddaughters, I made the choice to stop feeling negatively about it, and I even put up some little decorations because I don't want to be a buzzkill for them. But as much as I dislike it, I've never had a Valentine's Day quite as bad as Susan Hamilton's. For her, it was the last day of her life. This is the story of Dr. John Hamilton and the Valentine's Day murder. Let's get into it. February 14th, 2001. This is Dr. John Hamilton. He was a successful OBGYN with a large practice in Oklahoma City. This is Susan Hamilton, his wife. Susan was not only his wife, she was the manager of her husband's medical practice. She did the books and the insurance billing, she hired the staff, and she oversaw the daily events at the clinic. Many people that knew the couple believed John had really married up when he landed Susan. She was pretty and she was likable, and John was a bit nerdy and he looked older than he actually was. It was the second marriage for both John and Susan, and they had been married for 15 years. Their story was kind of a later in life fairy tale. John gave Susan a Porsche on the day they got married. They lived a luxurious lifestyle. By all accounts, the couple were very well liked. People in the area and patients alike adored Dr. Hamilton. He was highly respected and revered as an excellent physician. Susan was very popular and well liked, not only at the office and among patients, but by the social set. She had a group of friends at the country club, and the couple were always engaged in parties and social events. The marriage appeared to be a happy one, but as we know, things are not always as they appear to be. On Valentine's Day morning, John Hamilton went to the hospital to perform two early morning scheduled surgeries on his patients. Susan stayed at home. She made breakfast and drank her coffee, and then she got in the shower. When Dr. Hamilton was finished with the first surgery of the morning, he left the hospital and stopped at a store to buy his wife some flowers. He then headed back home to give his wife the flowers he'd purchased. When John arrived at the house, he immediately saw that something was wrong. As you can see here, the back door is wide open. John headed upstairs, somewhat concerned, to find his wife. As he entered their bedroom, he was surprised to see that the bed was still unmade. Susan always made the bed as soon as she got up. John continued on into the main bathroom of the home, and there he found his wife, lying face down on the bathroom floor just outside the shower. In a panic, John knelt beside her, turned her over, and began administering CPR. He also called 911. The call went to dispatch, and the operator tried to talk to the doctor as he explained what was happening. But John was in such a panic, the operator couldn't really get any instruction to him. She later said she was surprised that a doctor would be so hysterical, knowing that time was of the essence. She was a bit taken aback by the fact that this doctor would not be calm in a crisis. Paramedics arrived on the scene, but there was nothing anyone could do for Susan Hamilton. She was dead. Immediately, the police began to question neighbors as they cordoned off the neighborhood and the crime scene. None of the neighbors had heard anything unusual. In the beginning, the police theorized that a burglar had broken into the house, perhaps believing there was no one home. They were surprised by Susan Hamilton and killed her. In this theory, the burglar then escapes out the back door, leaving it open. The house was in a very affluent area. Its residents were wealthy. They were members of country clubs and elite social groups. It was easy to see why a burglar would target the beautiful and expensive home, because anyone would assume there are going to be valuables inside. The police also had another theory. As part of Dr. Hamilton's OBGYN practice, as part of the healthcare he provided to his patients, he provided abortions. Had some lunatic come after Susan Hamilton, angry at her husband for providing that service? Police knew they definitely had to look into that as a possibility. As they began to investigate that angle, they found out that Dr. Hamilton and the clinic that Susan helped run had been targeted by anti-abortion protesters. The group even made up fake wanted posters for Dr. Hamilton, calling him a murderer and saying he was wanted by the Almighty God for the healthcare services he was providing. Don't you love it how some people always think they know exactly what God wants? And what God wants is always what they want. I love it here. Dr. Hamilton and his wife, Susan, were not scared off by the protests. They believed in the service they were providing for their patients, and they continued to include that service as part of their practice. But remember, this is the Bible Belt. With some extremists, there's nothing quite as hateful as Christian love, right? I know good Christians agree with me on that. At the police station, John Hamilton was placed in an interrogation room. He was inconsolable. He was shaking the tables and chairs around, crying into a handkerchief. He kept saying, "Please help me, please help me, please help me," over and over in an almost robotic tone. After a few hours, John was released and the police went about investigating the scene. There was quite a bit of forensic evidence to be gathered and a team was brought in to begin that work. Susan Hamilton's body was taken for autopsy. It was discovered that there was no evidence of sexual assault. Susan had been strangled with these neckties here. It appeared as though the killer had hastily grabbed a handful of ties at the time of the attack. Now, this played into the theory that it was a burglary gone wrong. The thief had entered the home only to steal and wasn't prepared with a weapon to use to kill someone. The fact that Susan was not sexually assaulted also led the police to believe burglary was the original motive, and her murder was simply a result of her being in the wrong place at the wrong time. The coroner found that after Susan was strangled, and perhaps during that process, her killer had picked up her head and slammed it against the floor several times. The killer had then struck Susan in the forehead with a very heavy object, and the forehead wound was most likely the one that killed her, or at least knocked her out. But they did not find that heavy object at the scene. The manner of death was ruled homicide by blunt force to the skull. As police investigated, they were contacted by an employee at the city office. This employee felt it was important to inform the police that the anti-abortion group that had protested at Dr. Hamilton's office from time to time had applied for and obtained a permit to hold a protest outside of Dr. Hamilton's residence, his house. Now, I don't care how you feel about abortion or any other controversial issue. I think most of us would agree it's not right or proper or even ethical to invade a neighborhood with protests. We have blurred so many lines in our society, and decency, I think, is the one that has been obliterated. I don't think it's decent to protest at someone's house. The neighbors don't deserve to be dragged into that kind of thing, and the kids that live in those neighborhoods don't need to see that, and I think it's wrong. But anyway, the police found that bit of information very interesting. The fact that this group had been given a permit to protest outside of the doctor's home. To them, it felt like this anti-abortion group was really stepping up its war against the doctor. And one of them, a member of that group, could very well end up being the person that killed Susan. As the police officers went through the Hamilton house, they found what would turn out to be a very important clue. On the kitchen counter was the Valentine's Day card that John had purchased to give to Susan. It read, "We are important, loving, caring people together. My life would be incomplete without you. I love you, John." Investigators also found the card that Susan had given to John. There was a different sentiment in that card. The card came with a pre-printed message in it, and that message started out, "I love being your wife." Over the top of that pre-printed message, Susan had written, "Obviously, I bought this card before last Monday." Woo! What happened on Monday? She had then written, "I bought this card 2 weeks ago, so it doesn't seem as appropriate now. I love you. Have a good day, Susan." So now it becomes obvious to the police something quite serious had happened between the couple, and it happened on the Monday before Valentine's Day. Police went to Dr. Hamilton and asked him, "What happened between the two of you? What does this message in the Valentine's Day card mean?" Dr. Hamilton told the police that he and Susan had had a very serious argument about money, but the police were gathering information that said it was much more than that. People were coming forward to let them know Dr. John Hamilton was having an affair. Neighbors believed John had been sleeping with one of his clients, a client who also worked as a stripper. Friends told investigators that Susan had become suspicious, and she ordered a set of John's phone records. There, she found all the proof she needed. Her husband had called this woman over 60 times in 1 month. This was as bad as anything Susan Hamilton could have imagined. This was something she never expected from her husband. They were close, and she thought they were happy. It was the ultimate betrayal in her mind, and Susan's world imploded. She was so angry that the night she found out about the woman, she packed a bag and left the house. She had gone to stay with a friend of hers, but she ended up returning to her home the next day. She told this friend that she was going to contact a divorce attorney. It seems that John had been able to somewhat, not fully, but somewhat convince Susan he hadn't had an affair, that he had been going to the strip club, and that yes, he had been calling this woman, but that was it. Susan sat John down and told him that if there was any hope of repairing their marriage, he was to end all communication with this woman. Susan even made John write a letter to this woman telling her that she could no longer be a patient at the clinic. He would no longer be her physician. But Susan still wasn't convinced. She had actually made a few phone calls to some divorce attorneys, and she had confided in several friends of hers that she was very seriously considering a divorce. Then the media got a hold of the 911 tapes, and after a few times listening, they began to form their own suspicions. Dr. Hamilton sounds strange on the recording. He is too panicked. He is too upset. He's not acting like a doctor. Of course, when you love someone that is hurt, it's different, obviously, but he was just over the top. Some reporters at a local news station hired a voice stress analyst to listen to the tapes. Now, I'm going to preface this by saying that I do not believe voice stress analysis is solid science. I've read studies that say the tests have very low accuracy, some less than 50%. So in my book, this is junk science. Back in 2001, it was kind of the new thing. So they bring in this analyst and he analyzes the 911 call and states that there is, quote, "no excessive blood flow to Dr. Hamilton's vocal cords," meaning he is faking the stress in his voice. I just don't buy this type of science. There's just no evidence to prove that it works. The voice analyst went as far as to say that he believes Dr. Hamilton rehearsed his call to the 911 operator, which again, how would you know that? That's too much for me. Then the media got a hold of the surveillance footage from the interview room. As I stated earlier, and as you can see here, John's behavior is strange. He's like climbing around on the table and the chairs. He's moving the furniture around. He's kneeling down and waving his hands around. It's very over-the-top behavior, like I said. But then you have cases where we say, well, he wasn't showing enough emotion. His affect was flat, you know? So even though I have my own opinions on how he's acting, we have to be careful we don't look at those things as evidence. None of us know how we would act in a situation like this, and it's not really right to look at the behavior as evidence. But he's trying a little too hard to seem distraught, in my opinion. The problem was Dr. Hamilton had been in surgery all morning. There was no debating that. This is a very solid alibi. This isn't, hey, I was driving to work. This is, hello, I was actually standing over a cut open human being in an operating room with my surgical staff. So now the police have to work out if they were going to believe that Dr. Hamilton killed his wife, which many of them did, how did he do it and when? Only days after the murder, the story had pretty much blown up. I mean, I can see why. You've got a rich couple, an affluent doctor and his beautiful wife. You've got protesters that want him dead, abortion protesters at that. They've made up wanted posters claiming God wants him dead. You've got a stripper, you've got a country club neighborhood. This story pretty much had it all. Police were relying heavily on the forensics to help them understand what had happened. This is a photo of Dr. Hamilton's shirt, the shirt he was wearing at the time of the murder. It is to be expected that he is covered in blood. He fully admitted to turning his wife over and to performing CPR on her. However, and I know this from a case that I actually worked, when you hold someone against you that is bleeding, the transfer appears as kind of a splotch, as if you were to take two things and put them together, so it transfers in kind of a splotchy pattern. That is not what the blood spatter expert found. The blood spatter expert discovered findings that created a very big problem for Dr. Hamilton. Blood evidence is, of course, much more solid than polygraph and voice stress analysis, but it is not infallible. Still, it's what the police had to rely on and probably their best evidence. The blood spatter expert said that he expected to see the stains on John's shirt that showed he had held his wife, that he had leaned into the blood. What he did not expect to see was blood spatter. Spatter only occurs during the murder. In this case, it would have occurred when the killer was striking Susan's head on the ground. And then, of course, when he raised the object up and hit Susan and brought it back and hit her again. Well, John Hamilton had blood spatter on him. He had it near his collar, and he had it on the sleeve of his shirt, and he had it around his abdominal area. And this was a very big deal, at least for the blood spatter expert. Now, the worst thing for Dr. Hamilton was that some of the blood was up inside the cuff of his shirt. Forensics blood experts can actually tell what side of the fabric the blood touched first. Even if it soaks all the way through, they can tell it came from the top or came from the bottom. And he had blood spatter inside his cuff. How would that have happened? The expert also found blood spatter on Dr. Hamilton's shoes that absolutely should not have been there. The droplets were all similar in shape. They had come from above and left a trail downward, meaning they had landed on the shoes with some velocity. Again, this would not happen by leaning over the body. But of course, the most telling blood spatter was on the inside of the sleeve cuff. There was high velocity spatter that had traveled up inside the sleeve and could not be explained away by holding the body. That kind of spatter could only happen from bringing back a weapon or striking her head like that. Maybe she's spitting blood up the sleeves of the shirt. I'm very animated today. The police then found something they never expected. As part of their routine investigation, they did a forensic analysis of John's car. In the car, they found Susan's blood on the steering wheel and on the driver's side seat. How in the world would that have transferred to John's car when he hadn't been in the car since arriving home, finding his wife, and calling 911? It couldn't have. The blood in the car was the nail in Dr. John Hamilton's coffin. Police knew he had murdered his wife. They then conducted an even more extensive test of the car and found Susan Hamilton's tissue on the floorboards. Of course, there is no way to explain that away. The police called the Hamiltons' maid in for questioning. She told them that there was a very large marble figurine, like a decorative piece, that was missing from the bathroom. The police asked her, "Are you sure it was there?" And she said, "Yes, it was always there. I wiped it down every time I cleaned the bathroom." So then police knew that was probably the murder weapon. They got records from the hospital and, using John's phone and pager system, discovered that there was a time gap between the first surgery and the second surgery where John was not in the hospital. In fact, the hospital had to page John several times asking him to come back because his second patient was prepared and ready for surgery. John hadn't come forward willingly with the information that he left the hospital between the first and second surgery. So as John's out purchasing the flowers, the hospital staff is at the hospital panicking. The patient had already been sedated, put under anesthesia because the doctor didn't tell anyone he was leaving. So they've got this patient prepared for surgery and knocked out with no doctor. So this served as further evidence that John Hamilton wasn't available when he should have been because he was at home murdering his wife. Dr. John Hamilton was arrested and charged with the murder of his wife, Susan. The interest in the case was at an all-time high. The public was fascinated with the story of a wealthy doctor and his beautiful wife living in a wealthy neighborhood, and it was all a lie. The doctor was actually a cheating louse, and he had murdered his wife on Valentine's Day. It was a story made for the media. Investigators then discovered that John Hamilton had a secret bank account that Susan didn't know about. Using that account, John was funneling money to one of his adult children from a previous marriage. Susan's ex-husband explained to the media that Susan was the boss in any family she was in and that she controlled everything. When Susan found out that John had been hiding this money transfer from her, it was a very big deal. Now, I'm not sure why a man has to have permission to send his own money to one of his children when he's the one making the money, but that's a different conversation. The police bring the stripper in for questioning. She tells them that there was no relationship. She tells them that she knew full well John was working up the courage to ask her to sleep with him, but that he never had. Now, I don't know what to believe on this. I tend to kind of believe the stripper. If I was Susan, it wouldn't really have mattered to me if they were sleeping together or not. The behavior alone would be enough for me to peace out. But anyway, the stripper did say it never happened. At trial, prosecutors put forth the following theory. They said John Hamilton and Susan had exchanged Valentine's Day cards earlier in the morning, and that there was most likely an argument about what Susan had written in her card. Prosecutors called it a forced exchange of sentiments because it was Valentine's Day, and they said that caused John Hamilton to snap. They told the jury they believed he went to the hospital and performed his first surgery. When he was finished, he went and bought the flowers and returned home, hoping to reconcile with his wife. Instead, an argument ensued and John went ballistic. He grabbed some of his ties out of the closet and he strangled Susan with them. When she was down, he struck her head on the cold tile floor and then he grabbed the marble figurine and hit her with it. Before he had time to clean up, he began receiving pages from the hospital telling him it was urgent that he return. He wrapped the marble figurine in his bloody pants and threw his jacket on over the shirt that already had high-velocity blood spatter up the sleeve, and then he returned to the hospital. They theorize he put on a clean pair of pants, threw on a blazer over the shirt that had the blood spatter up the sleeves, and then dumped the marble figurine wrapped in the pants somewhere on his way back to the hospital. But the forensic evidence really proved that when John got back into the car, his shoes and somewhere else on him obviously transferred blood and tissue to the driver's side of the car. When he got back to the hospital, he scrubbed in and performed his second surgery. He then got dressed and went back home where he pretended to find his wife dead on the floor. The problem for the doctor is that he was still wearing the shoes covered in almost invisible blood spatter, and he was still wearing that shirt with spatter up the sleeve. He wrongly assumed that any blood on him could be explained away by the fact that he admittedly turned Susan over and held her at the crime scene. Just as an aside, as a thought, can you imagine being the patient in the second surgery? Like, you guys. You find out later on that the man who was performing surgery on you had just murdered his wife minutes earlier. Like, beat her to death and strangled her. That is some kind of psychopathy, isn't it, that allows a man to do something so brutal and then return with a steady enough hand to perform surgery. It's the human mind is pretty amazing, often terrible, but always fascinating. At trial, there was this real-life Perry Mason moment, which is something that just never happens, and I can't figure out why this happened. People don't realize when you go to trial, you already know what everyone is going to say. There is a process called discovery that takes place before trial, so there aren't any surprises. Witnesses are deposed in the process of discovery and statements are made. And when you hire an expert, you know what that expert is going to say before you put them on the stand. You pay them to say what they're going to say. Well, for whatever reason, the blood spatter expert hired by the defense, hired by Dr. Hamilton, ended up doing something that never happens. He stated on the witness stand that he had to concur with the prosecution's blood spatter expert. He had to agree with him that yes, John Hamilton killed his wife. Again, I have no idea how this happened. This expert had to have told the defense attorneys he was not going to say that, or they never would have put him on the stand. But in the end, it was just the icing on the cake for the jury, who was most likely going to convict Dr. Hamilton anyway. That's exactly what they did. John Hamilton was convicted for the murder of his wife, Susan, and was sentenced to life in prison without parole. This is what he looks like now. He is housed at the R.B. Dick Connor Correctional Facility in Hominy, Oklahoma. He is currently 75 years old, and he will never leave prison. Thank you for joining me today on this Valentine's edition of Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. Hit the like button if you like the video, subscribe to my channel if you want to support me, and if you really want to support me, join my Patreon. It helps more than I can even tell you guys. It is rough here on YouTube, and the Patreon, it's what I'm holding on to at this point. Happy Valentine's Day, my friends. If you're alone, just remember, the greeting card companies made this holiday up. And you love yourself, right? Plus, you're part of our little community here, and that makes me so happy. Stay safe, my friends, and be kind to each other. And I'll see you next time on Dining with Death. Bye.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.